Coming up next, a abbreviated version of Technology Bytes, not in show length, but in hosts.
Listeners should be aware that the following program contains language and audio images which may be found disturbing and may not be suitable for your snotty-nosed little brat who probably cusses like a sailor behind your back anyway. Parental discretion is advised.
Greetings and welcome to tonight's edition of Technology Bytes from the Lysol blasted studio here.
Studio 54.
This is horrible.
The morning after. Yes, it does smell like somebody set off some kind of hair product bleach bomb.
It's insane. Like I'm almost tearing up. My nostrils are burning.
Yeah, it's interesting. All right, so. Well, welcome to Technology Bytes. We're flying in triple missing geek formation.
We're flying in decimated formation.
Yeah, I just wanted to get on here and say that I can't make it for the show tonight.
I was going to leave early. Welcome to Technology Bytes. I'm Jay Lee.
I'm Peter Hughes.
I'm Flicked.
Yeah, we got Lee Hutchinson is out recovering from illness.
Barrett, or so he claims.
Or so he claims. He might have thought it was still
fundraiser. I sent him an email and said, you know, fundraiser actually ended at 6 p.m. if that helps you suddenly recover.
Better. Yeah. Groovehouse is in Hawaii and enjoying apparently a comedy of some errors going on down there.
I haven't heard about it.
Yeah. He apparently no rent car when he got there and something was wrong with his room. But it's Hawaii. He couldn't get into one part of Hawaii because it's closed off due to dengue fever.
Oh, wow.
So anyway, they're off doing their thing. Barrett is off in Costa Rica. Groovehouse is in Hawaii, and Lee is laid up in bed, probably. Says he's sick. He got the fundraiser flu, I think, but didn't realize there was no fundraiser. So
I thought Barrett was getting a full Brazilian or something.
We can only hope that that's not the case. Or if it is, that we won't hear any more about it ever.
Or we can just not make any mental picture of
it. Right.
No Instagram posts.
All right. Well, anyway, you can check out our website at geekradio.com where we post the show links and the podcasts and the announcements for the geek gatherings. You can also hang out with us on IRC, irc.cuckoo.com, in the channel Tech Bytes. If you don't know how to use the IRC, we have an IRC client posted to our website that you can use to come on in the channel and play with us. And other than that, it's going to be 2 hours of J. Pete Inflicted.
I'm going to derail this right off the bat. Did you see the new Dynamo secondary kit that got released today?
What is the secondary kit? So no,
it's like kind of like Home and Away, but not always. Sometimes they wear them, but it's kind of like their secondary uniform.
Oh, okay, right. It's not their main uniform, but it's when they wear for special occasions or when they're
if they're playing a team that has a color that they need to alternate from.
Right. Yeah. In case somebody else comes out in blinding bright orange.
So yeah, so traditionally their secondary kit has been white. And now it's not. Now it's black. It's actually really cool looking. It's a really cool looking kit. I'm probably gonna get one. Yeah.
What about you, Pete? You gonna get a Dynamo kit?
No, maybe I'll get a just regular Dynamo. You know, like an electric one.
Get a Dynamo Hum.
Run a lot of volts through it.
Votes, run the votes. Run the votes through the Dynamo. All right, so it's just weird because it's just me Inflicted in the studio and in the disembodied voice of Pete in my head. So I feel like this is not really a real show. I feel like, you know, this is like where you dream you went to work or school without any pants on.
Hey, you need to put your pants back on, actually.
The voice in my head.
I can't tell from here.
The voice in my head told me to get dressed.
At least you've got a shirt on, so.
I do have that. Alrighty, so that's all the relative information. We don't have the usual. I'm in this room by myself.
I know, you could be like a Shetland pony centaur.
For all you hope.
Because, you know, you're not very tall, and you couldn't be sitting down really unless you were pretty short.
So you're saying that the hair that I don't have on my head, I might have in a glorious tail? The things you I really am asleep, aren't I?
You look down, do you see the body of a Shetland pony?
No. All right, let's.
What about now?
Or if you wake up and it's still fun to drive, that could be.
Oh yeah, well, we want to also, while I'm thinking about it, since you mentioned that, thank you to everyone who pledged your support and donate. Wow, that is an engine sound outside the studio. For those of you that called and pledged,
that was the right frequency to go right through
all
the wall
and come out on the air. All right, so anyway, thanks to everyone who pledged during the fundraiser. It's over for now till the next one, but thanks to everyone who participated. And the one time we made our goal, that was pretty awesome. But all the
pledges, we blew past our goal. That was
right. All the pledges, though, everything, even the days we didn't make our goal, were still successes. We had people call in and say, "I support KPFT and I support Technology Bites," and that's good to hear. That's good to know. And we thank you for doing that for us and for the station. And we hope that you'll stick around now while we do.
So is this going to be like a retro show? Like we're actually going to take calls
or something? I don't know. We still have the segments, I suppose. It just depends on how much banter the three of us can come up with on these stories.
Yeah, well, one thing I'm thinking is with this few people is when we do each of the stories, I'll do one story and we can talk about it right after it. Because there won't be so many people, you know, involved in the conversation.
Right.
If there's anything anyone wants to say on a given subject, we can just have a little bit of conversation then. There's plenty of stuff. I mean, there's plenty of articles and plenty of interesting things happening.
Okay.
So it's not, fortunately, it's not on one of those like thin news weeks where we hope that there's like a good movie out that we can fill 25 minutes with or something.
All right. Well, let's do it. So you're saying you want to do the info shot a story at a time?
Yeah. Basically, we can do the story and talk about anything that has to do with it if we want after each one, and then just go through that and see where it takes us.
Okay.
So you have to come up with something insightful after every one. See the pressure? People will be sitting at home and going, what's he going to say about that story?
I was really counting on that 15, 20 minutes of not having to do anything.
I agree completely. That's a good one.
That's correct, Pete.
Thanks for that.
But if you fall asleep in this current dream, it'll last a lot longer, according to Inception.
Oh, man.
Eventually the show would be days long.
All right, well, take it away, InfoShot.
It's the Technology Bytes InfoShot. Technology news and commentary by Peter Hughes. Injected directly into your skull.
Okay, our first story is something that's never happened before, and one has to kind of wonder why not. There's the NSA Advisory Board, the National Security Agency. The president's NSA Advisory Board grew teeth in the wake of the Snowden revelations, and they've done good service in identifying the civil liberties issues raised by the NSA's program of security of secret mass surveillance. But one of the things that's been a problem for them is up until now, the NSA Advisory Board didn't have any high caliber tech experts on it. You know, the kind of person who could spot like mathematical errors used in the big data projects used to identify candidates for assassination, things like that. But that has now changed. As of this week, the board has a tech expert, the legendary Steve Belovin, co-director of Columbia's Cybersecurity and Privacy Center, and author of such papers as Keys Under Doormats, A Spectacular Broadside Against Government Backdoors in Crypto. Here's a good quote from an article on him. The most important thing about the NSA's spy programs, Belovin says, is not what gets stated openly about them, but what their implications are. Implications are often obscured to anyone who doesn't grasp the full technical capabilities of the spy tools the government uses. Belovin says his role will not only be to determine to understand the implication of the tools, but also to determine if there's a better way to accomplish the government's intelligence goals while still preserving privacy and civil liberties. Although he doesn't know yet the specific programs he'll be focusing on, the board has already told him he'll be looking at surveillance programs that have been authorized by Executive Order 12333, one of the least understood and most wide-sweeping authorities the government uses for spying. So there's a nice step forward where they actually get somebody who, could be an expert at this stuff instead of, you wonder, what were they doing before? Where were they finding these people? You know, hey, you look bored. Why don't you want to be on the NSA advisory board? It's all secret. So if you screw up, nobody will ever know. So there's that one. I don't know that that's one that leads to lots of conversation. If you can say pass, and we'll move on to the next thing.
We can go find out what was making that noise outside, and it was like a little white station wagon Saturn or something with just the lowest rumble. It was coming in through the walls. It was just amazing. So I didn't pay attention too much to the first
one. Oh, okay. Well, we'll go to this next one, which is actually kind of one of the bigger things going on right now. This one is – it isn't often that a tech story actually kind of gets to the consciousness of, like, regular media, besides the usual places, you know, like Engadget and Wired and those types of places. This one is all over the place. Apple has had – there's a court order to Apple – that they have to help the FBI unlock an iPhone there was the case in San Bernardino where Syed Farouk is the suspect and his wife. They had iPhones, I guess, and the FBI still has not been able to unlock Syed Farouk's phone to search for critical clues in the case. So, both Farouk and his wife are dead. It was a phone that he was given by his work, but he set up the security on it. He set the PIN and all that. And another thing that one should know is that on an iPhone, if you guess wrong 10 times trying to unlock an iPhone, then it wipes it clean. Everything gone, not recoverable. So yesterday it was revealed that Farouk's phone was an iPhone 5C running iOS 8 or above. When a U.S. federal judge ordered Apple to help the FBI recover data from the device, within hours of the ruling, Apple CEO Tim Cook posted an open letter on the company's website stating that Apple opposes the judge's order. The order and Apple's opposition to it sets the stage for a fight over one of the most critical issues of our times, the right to individual privacy provided by encryption versus the needs of security organizations to access an individual's data under extreme circumstances for the good of national security. Apparently, you know, early on, smartphones were like a really were the policeman's friend, because the first thing they wanted to do is get their hands on that phone because it has your life in it. You know, so once the, so if they could get your smartphone as part of the investigation, often everything that the police needed was just sitting right there and easy to get. Well, now encryption has gotten, now the security, you know, customers want secure phones. Apple has been working to give them that security, and now the deal is that with the introduction of iOS 8, the Apple built-in and enabled encryption on all iOS devices as well as Macs. The encryption was created to be so tight and secure that even Apple could not crack it if the user lost his password. It was designed this way on purpose to limit Apple's ability to hack into a user's phone, even if ordered by a security agency. So this has been a major point of consternation between the federal government and Apple. Speaking at the Wall Street Journal live conference last October, Tim Cook expressed his and Apple's ethos as the reason why it incorporates encryption even Apple can't break. When asked a what-if scenario involving the ability to foil a 9/11 with the help of backdoors built into iOS software, Cook said, quote, "No one should have to decide between privacy or security. We should be smart enough to do both. What we've said is that one of the key tenets that we feel very strongly about is that you can't have a backdoor in the software, because you can't have a backdoor that's only for the good guys. Any backdoor is something the bad guys can exploit." So we have a link to the letter that Tim Cook posted on the website, and links, like Jay mentioned earlier, to all the articles we're going to talk about tonight, so you can read more and find out more. So it's going to be interesting to see what happens. Some of the stuff, though, that's coming out with this is he says that Cook says that Apple's complied with valid subpoenas and search warrants in the San Bernardino and other cases, but says, quote, "Now the U.S. government has asked us for something we simply do not have and something we consider too dangerous to create. They've asked us to build a backdoor to the iPhone." He goes on to drop the bombshell that the FBI is requesting Apple make a new version of iOS for them, which would allow the agency to install it on confiscated phones and bypass all the security features built into the public iOS. Cook says that building such software, which he stresses does not exist today, would undermine decades of security advances and have serious ramifications for tens of millions of American citizens' privacy if it fell into the wrong hands, or even if it was misused by people who had it legally, quite frankly. So now... this one, it's let's see. They don't really say what happens next. I'm assuming this is going to go through the courts, and I guess the way it closes is, while we believe the FBI's intentions are good, it would be wrong for the government to force us to build a backdoor into our products, said Cook, ending his letter. And ultimately, we fear that this demand would undermine the very freedoms and liberty our government is meant to protect. So, it is interesting that this is apparently so secure that the FBI can't figure out how to get around it.
Well, I think it's interesting that they can't get it. That the FBI at least is claiming they can't get into it, or the NSA isn't saying they can get into it. It makes me wonder, you know, somebody had mentioned one time that in a scenario like something like this, that it's possible that the government wouldn't want to reveal that they had this capability. So now they're pushing for Apple to to create it for them so that they can, you know, deny that they already might have this ability.
Although you'd think they'd, you know, I guess this one is right now, at least the public face fits all the FBI. You know, you've got to wonder, you'd think that they would just leave it quiet, although I guess Apple would know that they didn't help them and that the feds had their own tool to do it if they suddenly had data off the phone. You know, it seems like, I guess the thing about with like a phone is the PIN isn't one of those things that you're allowed to forget, or the Touch ID. I guess it was a 5C. So you can't really, because I was thinking about it earlier, it's kind of like, well, what about the kind of stuff where you just reset the password and you know, reset things, you know, do the I forgot my password kind of stuff. And if you have control of their email account, then you have the door open for whatever.
It seems odd that the I wonder if the guy had, you know, set up the fingerprint scan on it, the biometric, and if they tried all 10 of his fingers to get in.
Or if they thought about that before they I think that's set up to where you have to, it has to be I think this came up and we talked about it a few weeks ago. It has to be a live finger, that it's it's not like the old ones where you could just Xerox a fingerprint.
And the NSA doesn't want to reveal their reanimation technology at all.
Yeah, the zombie tech is the super secret stuff, but it's an interesting question. I lean towards Apple's side on this. It's kind of like nothing in the Constitution says that we have to make things convenient or simple or easy for law enforcement. You know, if you put evidence inside a safe that nobody could open, they can order you to, and I guess, you know, do put you where you in contempt of court or something like that if you didn't open it. But there's not really any way they can, you know, force you to. They can't use that to say you're guilty. Right. So, it kind of seems like making it where they dumb down the protections that are built into your operating systems and all that kind of stuff. The thing that worries me is that then you're exposed to everybody, every hacker, every.
Right. I mean, once the back door's there, then, you know, you can't. I mean, I'm actually encouraged by the fact that the FBI couldn't get into the phone. You know, not because I'm worried about the FBI getting into my phone, but I'm worried about someone who might want to get into my phone to compromise my accounts. I have a lot of things hooked up in my phone that are linked to my bank account and linked to my email, and I don't want someone. I want to at least feel like, you know, my phone is safe. And I do like the fact that more and more people are password protecting their phones. You don't tend to see it's kind of like the way that, you know, you don't see so many unsecured Wi-Fi access points anymore. Those times are changing, and they have changed.
Part of the aspect of this that's interesting to me is that Apple released a letter publicly and said what was going on and said that they didn't support it and said that they didn't want to do it. Because I think in years past, that didn't happen. Large companies did not do that. There are post Snowden maybe changed some of that, but before Snowden's revelation, or actually even before Snowden, it had already come out that there were some major telco players that had allowed the government to put, like Carnivore and some of the like large listening devices that were on major backbones of the internet routers in America to capture all traffic to see what they could find, right? And that wasn't publicly stated or anything. In addition to that, there were some hardware manufacturers that had come out that allowed backdoors into areas. Whereas, you know, a few years before that, these are American companies, right? A year or 2 years before that, there had been this big uproar about the fact that a major router manufacturer out of China, this is Huawei, I don't know how you pronounce it, but supposedly, you know, the Chinese government was putting backdoors into the routers by this company who were selling cheaper than some American companies. How dare they do that? You know, and then it came out that some American companies had allowed that to happen with their products with the American government. And so to me, it's kind of interesting that the Apple has taken a very different approach, which I think is good. They've taken a very different approach to that instead of just hiding it and saying we're going to do it and nobody's going to know about it, that they've actually come out and said we don't want to do it and we don't think it's right and we're going to try to fight this to not make it happen.
Well, and another thing, you know, a kind of similar detail with when you talk about foreign governments is if Apple will do that for the U.S. government, then the door opens for other governments that maybe aren't as democratic or so on as us. And then how is Apple supposed to tell them, oh, no, we can't do that?
Right. I mean, the only thing I can see is that, you know, they are an American company, so that probably has a little bit, like, they, you know, the U.S. government may have more jurisdiction because they're an American company or whatever. But that is definitely something that has to be considered because, yeah, I mean, once the American government does it, then there's no reason for other countries' governments to not try to do it and say that they
well, if they know
well.
The U.S. has, if they know the U.S. has the ability to, you know, get in backdoor into Apple phones, then would that kill? There'd be countries where I think that would kill Apple's market too.
Yeah. Yeah, that's probably the case. And they would probably stick a lot of government-hired hackers to try to find, you know, get that information out of the American government's hands or just to, you know, brute force it themselves, which is doable. I mean, and history has shown that that definitely happens.
Well, yeah, and the FBI asking for, like, a backdoor, at least based on kind of how they've used technology up to the present, it's sort of, you know, I can't think of a really good way to put it other than that, you know, that they're sort of, the FBI seems to have been at about an AOL 1992 level of sophistication on any of this stuff. And so the back door that you'd have to open for them would be like, you know, oh, it'd be like the fence with the, like, hook and eye up by the top of the fence, you know, by the top of the gate where you just have to reach over and kind of flip your finger and you're in. So,
yeah, I mean, the thing is that this sort of stuff has kind of come up in the past, not this specific situation, but sort of related. I mean, even with, like, encryption in general, you know, it comes up that, like, oh, there should be backdoors, that this should be allowed, and or even with, like, when the government we did find out about Carnivore and some of that other stuff, you know, they were saying, oh, well, you know, this should be allowed or it's only metadata, although maybe it wasn't always just metadata, but even if it is, but whether it is or isn't, you know, that they're collecting all this information, well, it's good because, you know, it could save us from an attack or whatever. And I mean, I think that's that's the best angle to pitch that for an emotional reaction from people.
Although on this one, the people are dead. Their terrorism act is completed, or has, you know, they did as much of it as they were as they could do. So the usually the example is that there's the ticking bomb. You know, there's the I don't know. They find that there's the, like, innocent baby is on top of the ticking bomb, and, you know, they, like, stack it so heavy. So that you know, the idea being that no rational person would say, no, you can't, you know, we still need encryption. But
but the thing is, you can't really do this once. I mean, once you've done it once, it exists.
And it means that there is an open door somewhere. And so Apple, on the one hand, is there's a bit of sort of security through obscurity, except you're talking about Apple knows the operating system like nobody else and would know where the back door, where the flaw was put in to make it work, and all of that, as opposed to just, you know, the kind of security through obscurity. Oh, well, we just won't tell anybody.
Well, I'm pretty sure the FBI could very possibly go on some, you know, darknet websites and some you know, some of that stuff, and maybe find some illegitimate foreign hackers that for a price would be willing to access the phone for them.
Is there any way? Sounds... I wonder if there's any way for the. I mean, could they? Could Apple or whoever give them access to like the SMS or the text messages, or could they get access to that from the telco? Or would it be possible to monitor the phone in some way through the Wi-Fi to sniff the traffic to, or not the Wi-Fi, I guess, but through the cellular connection to see where it's sending information to find out where it might have a mail account set up or something like that? I mean, I don't know the answer to that question.
I would think as long as the phone is running and processes are still running, then, yeah, you could probably get some information by the
traffic that it goes on. I mean, you turn my phone off and you turn it back on, it's going to be making requests to my social media accounts and my email.
Right. I mean, and as long as – if he was using it for that kind of stuff, you know, most people set their phones up to auto-check their mail every so often, you know.
But
I mean,
you could learn.
You don't have to.
I mean, it's not like I think the information on the phone especially, not like a laptop or a desktop, but the information on the phone is mostly going to be communications with either through email or to other phones, phone logs and stuff like that. So it doesn't sound to me, and I mean, I'm not a nerd or anything, so I don't know, but it seems to me that there would be a way to get at the information that it was transmitting, that part is where they could find what they needed. They could see that there must be something that tracks like where the phone's been, that kind of stuff.
So sometimes also to like, from my perspective, which I'm sure everybody doesn't share this, but specifically with electronic stuff, like just because something is possible or could be doable doesn't mean that it should be done, you know?
Right.
I've had issues with that, like when companies start doing stuff with email, where they're like scanning and harvesting employee email or whatever like that, like instant messaging conversations, stuff like that. Like, well, we're gonna catalog all instant messaging conversations that happen on the company servers. Like, yeah, you can do that, but to me, that's like saying, okay, well, we're going to record everything you do. Like when you come into work, you have to have a recorder on your personal bot, you know, somewhere on your person, and you have to turn it on. You have to record like every conversation that you have during the day. And then at the end of the day, that'll be uploaded to a server. And then we'll analyze all the speech to see like who you talked to and what you said. And that's obviously not as easily doable, but it is easy to capture, you know, on the server, the IM server, the log, you know, of conversations. So I kind of feel that way about encryption as well. Like, you know, just because it's possible to put a backdoor in encryption because you might be able to do something good with it doesn't mean that you should do it.
Well, and looking at the article, it sounds like somebody at the FBI has been thinking, because the request, it sounds like, is for Apple to make what looks like an upgrade to the operating system that can be uploaded. See, to that phone. Although, you know, that seems to be what they're asking for, but it's kind of like, okay, well, how do you get that on there? Because normally you have to authenticate yourself to run an update.
I would think, I mean, no, you know what? I think it's possible that Apple has the ability, if it's considered a major security update, to push it to phones without requiring the end user to accept it.
But wouldn't that be a bear if they try to push it to it and they get the message that many of us with the phones that don't have the huge memory capacity, there is not enough space on this phone. Please delete some apps or data to make room. So this one is going to be around, and it'll be an interesting conversation. I think one of the things that's interesting about it is I don't think that this particular question comes down in any place that you could map to, say, political parties, where one party would be for and one would be against in an obvious way. And so the discussion on it should be very different than a lot of other issues that get kind of mired in the politics.
Usually the encryption stuff tends to kind of cross different lines than party lines.
Well, because you hit that place where there's civil liberties on the one side and, you know, the limitations on the power of government and the law and order thing on the other side.
Right.
And the party that has kind of both of those things the most, it's one party has both of those in the same one.
Right.
And so it plays out differently. It doesn't come down like, again, where it doesn't do the normal cleavages of party and that here. So, so it's going to be interesting to see. And you, so you just wonder, I mean, I guess it's going to go up through the courts and they'll decide what the legality is on it. I mean, I don't think that there doesn't seem to be anything illegal about Apple doing this. It's not like they're making special encryption that only terrorists can use. This is everybody who uses their products gets it. So it's just sort of, you know, I think this one, certainly we're going to be talking about it some more in the future. I guess our next up, how many people use an ad blocker? Apparently, around the last half of 2015, a number of high profile publishers like Forbes, The Washington Post, and GQ began experimenting with erecting ad block walls. It's the latest attempt to ward off the damaging effects of ad blocking, but there's not a lot of evidence to show the new technique is really working. The majority of them work by detecting when an ad blocker enters the site and prevents them from viewing any content until they either turn off the ad blocker or hand over some money in the form of a long-term subscription or a micropayment. Lots of publishers have been declaring their ad blocker walls a relative success. PageFair's head of ecosystem, Dr. Johnny Ryan, in a report for the International News Media Association entitled "What to Do About Ad Blocking," said a smattering of publishers have released early results. Forbes said its experiment led to 42.3% of those asked either disabling their ad blockers or whitelisting Forbes.com. City AM said more than a quarter of readers turned off their ad blockers in its trial. GQ, which is asking for users to either turn off their ad blocker or pay a micropayment of between 25 and 50 cents, had a 30% take-up rate, according to the report. IDG Communications said 37% of its B2B audience and 38% of its B2C, business to consumer, in case you don't have the jargon. B2B is business to business. 38% of its business to consumer audience whitelisted the publisher once asked. But PageFair, which helps publishers measure their ad blocking traffic and find ways to monetize their audience, said a test across its own clients' websites of such ad block appeal walls yielded, quote, poor results. It ran 576 appeal campaigns across 220 publisher sites and found only 0.33% of ad blocker users added an exception for the publisher. Of those users, only one-third made temporary exceptions, just 0.22%. So 0.2% permanently whitelisted the publisher. So obviously it's going to be going forward. It's going to it comes up to, you know, again, the battle between the ads and the ad blockers. And it sounds like so far the tools to make people not block the ads are not working very well.
They are getting better at detecting ad blockers on sites because they're limiting content. Hey, we see you're using an ad blocker. You can't come any further.
So you've run across that. Well, I don't use an ad blocker. I use this really interesting free ad blocker called Ignoring Them, Ignoring the Ads. And so now that they pretty much don't have the now that they don't play sound automatically when you go to the page, then I'm able to, you know, I basically just I maybe look at the ads, but I don't I don't pay that much attention to them.
I didn't realize that Gmail was posting ads until I turned my ad blocker off.
They are.
Yeah, like the first, there's two sponsored messages at the top of the web interface for Gmail.
Yeah, I use an ad blocker.
I use an ad blocker because it cleans up my Facebook. It cleans up a lot of stuff. But I guess, I do remember, I remember a very serious conversation in the early days of the internet about how advertising, it was what was going to pay for content on the web, and that really, if we wanted to enjoy the benefits of this great resource that was to become, you know, what we now know as the modern internet, that ads were okay. You know, there was an assumption, I suppose, back then that ads would be promoted and pushed out in some kind of ethical, you know, good way. You know, that you would go to a website and there might be an ad there on the side or down below or directing you to a car manufacturer or a soda creator or something like that. I don't think anybody knew what was coming in terms of...
Well, or it was supposed to be. One of the things that was going to be the side effect is that you weren't going to mind the ads because they were going to be customized to meet your special needs. And so far, that one I haven't seen a lot of articles about, but, you know, it seems like most of their efforts on that front were not spent finding things that meet my special needs. It's more like, oh, you went to this site, so we're going to follow you around the internet and paste ads for that site and those products you looked at on every single page that you go to that we can shove an ad into. And it doesn't, it's kind of creepier than, it's creepier than expected because of the way they're doing it. It's not like they're kind of, learning about you in a way that they can put interesting ads. Cause I get like, there's some email, there's some companies that do email marketing, you know, that send out ads about their furniture or about, you know, just, you know, combination groupings of deals, computer deals and stuff like that. And I they come to my inbox and I look at them. They don't get filtered off into junk and I read them because it's something I'm interested in. But they haven't really seemed to get to there on the web.
Yeah. I get annoyed because especially like, oh, I need to go look for a gift for someone, you know, that I'm getting a gift. So I poke around for, you know, a few hours.
Don't do that when you're signed into your Amazon account. suggested stuff that comes up later is just traumatizing.
Well, I mean, but it's not even now. It's not even local to the, you know, I'll do that and then I'll make my decision. I'll purchase something. And then for the next 2 weeks on all these different sites I go to, I'll be seeing ads for whatever it was that I was looking for. Well, no, I'm interested in that for myself, but I'm talking about something that I might not be.
Non-brony stuff.
I think Flick is about to come out of the brony closet.
It'd be about 20% cooler if I did.
I just think you need to get a mighty colorful tail. A rainbow tail.
You know, my family did get me a My Little Pony coffee mug for Christmas.
Nice.
So I have that.
I will say
you have no idea how gleeful I was when I was at Comic-Con last year and I found my podium that I could stand at, like some My Little Pony dictator. And I said, I've got to do this for Flickton.
And then a lot of bronies liked your post.
Yeah, it was really a false flag operation to draw the bronies out.
I'm surprised that picture of yours hasn't gotten more spread on the internet.
Yeah. I'm kind of glad that it hasn't.
It's in a lot of private collections.
Yeah, so when the brony gets arrested and they find, oh, look, this is hardcore.
When they come and question you, we found your it was in a collection that was very disturbing. And
we need to talk to you.
Did you take this picture?
Show us on the My Little Pony doll.
Boy, how do we get off on this tangent? Oh, yeah, advertisements.
Yeah, I guess they need My Little Pony blockers that even work on the radio. Yeah, well, I think the toughest part is that there's no easy answer on it. obviously, when they start taking anti-ad blocker approaches, it means that they do feel it's hurting their revenue. And so they're making efforts on it. But you look at the newspaper business, if you really think about it, and the TV business, they had a lot less precise approach to it. The deal is, we throw 1 million newspapers, or 300,000 newspapers a day. And so your ad being in there, you're on page 47J of the thing. Well, you're paying X dollars for that because it's going to be thrown to 300,000 houses. And now that they've started to try to draw direct connections between, we showed this ad to 300,000 people and one of them clicked it and it was your mom, kind of thing. Now it's starting to get a little tougher. And you see the newspaper business, of course, is their ad dollars are going down. And I think part of that's because instead of it being that, oh no, newspapers work, so we spend our money with that, it's starting to turn into, well, now we try to track everything and it's not producing. And so you get there's the problem in print media of advertisements and that, but it's not as obvious as ad blocker. Obviously you can't kind of ad block a magazine or a newspaper, but and they also, obviously people are not rushing to subscribe to websites. They want this stuff for free. So it's an interesting, interesting conundrum. I don't know that anybody's really gotten to content that is so compelling that people will really pay up in an amount where they can support it, even to the level of like a newspaper. You look at the Huffington Post or some of those, and you get the it's gotten to the point where the link bait headlines are so extreme to try and get people to click the thing and look at it. That's clearly not a solution either, because those, after a while, you start getting, there were some that I would actually be, say, interested in the content, except when you get there and they want you to click, it's like 20 pictures or whatever, and every picture is on its own page surrounded by a new set of ads.
It's horrible. What's even worse is when they split that into two pages. So one has a picture and the next one has a picture with a comment about the picture.
Yeah. To double the...
Horrible.
It does not have the brilliance of lather, rinse, and repeat on the shampoo bottle. It's more like it's too obvious that they are just trying to make you have to stay around and look at the page. Oh, and another one that's a real favorite of mine is, so there's the slideshow and they hide the next button. And the ads all have like arrow buttons that look like they're part of the slideshow all around the picture. So you end up clicking and you wonder where you went because you click a link. And instead of seeing the next picture in the sequence or the slideshow or the subject, you're off on some marketing thing that has nothing to do with nothing. It's not even close to something I would be interested in on even on the most random of days. So it just kind of that's a sign of desperation too, as far as I can see. I mean, when they're just willing to take anybody, if they really think. That would be really close to if you were just walking through the mall and somebody ran out of a random store, grabbed you, and dragged you into their store. And how likely would you be to look around and go, oh, yeah, hey, I needed whatever the store happened, stationery. Yeah, I needed stationery. So I'll buy some since you kidnapped me. But, the alternative, of course, is I don't think they've found a way to really know what you want in a way to make it interesting and compelling to where you would click on the ad where they can sell you the stuff. And I don't know the solution on that. Cause I mean, there are sites I go to where I look at, the equivalent of, gear porn of one form or another, where it's, somebody's like the what's in my bag kind of sites, or the, everyday carry type stuff, or even the articles where it's like, we built the ultimate gaming machine today, or for this season. Those I go to on my own, and it's got brands on it and all that kind of stuff. But I don't think anybody's really figured out the way to make it compelling to to more people. I watch my kids with, you know, there's that whole generation is very into YouTube and YouTubers. And the thing about it is, even though where these people make their money is off those commercials on the front of the videos, once it says skip this video, they're on it. They are on it the millisecond that the skip this video link shows up. They are clicking it and moving on.
You have to pay a lot more attention to skip a video than to ignore it, because you're watching the counter countdown, so you can do it. So if the advertiser is smart, they get their message in that short period of time before the ad, before you're given a chance to skip, and they've actually accomplished more.
True.
I would think.
True. Well, and there's also the other thing that they've done that I've watched is they have the old school, like the old TV style and old radio show style, you know, and by old, I mean like the 40s and 50s, 30s, 40s and 50s, where they work the ad into the sort of into the content. And boy, the second they the second they segue to the part that's about that, that's basically an advertisement built into their show, my kids are gone. They like to watch the YouTube stuff on the main TV in the house, yeah. And so I get to see that, and so I watch, and they just the second they start that segue that they know is the part where they're going to do the ad, boom, gone. You know, the YouTube logo comes up because they're like, it's on the Wii U. They're looking on the screen to find the next video that they want to watch.
Well, there's two things that are happening, and I've already forgotten one of them, but there's two things that are happening that I find really,
three things
I remember them both now.
Three, my lord.
Five. No, so what I, some of my stories that I watch on TV that they, you know, they, I, the advertisers are getting smart, because like they, it'd be like a little mini car commercial inside of the show. Like the two main characters are driving from point A to point B, and then they'll show the logo of the car on the hood, and they're panning around, and then they'll demonstrate a feature like a backup camera, like the characters almost back over someone, and they'll, oh yeah, I got the backup camera, it saved our butts or whatever. So that happens in a lot of shows, and usually with cars. The other thing that happens that I hate, and it's car dealers again, is, and they try to make, and they've done a pretty good job where you go, oh, wait a minute, that's not the advertisement for a new movie about some action flick. You know, they're, they're making commercials look like movie trailers for action movies. And it's despicable. It almost got me to watch the commercial.
Yeah, I've heard there's an entire episode of one of the CSIs where they're just trapped in a Toyota Prius. Oh, I'm trying the backup camera. Wow, these seats are so comfortable. That you'd love to see them do that and just make it that obvious that it's just all commercial. But they're not going. Maybe the Simpsons would.
It would be a lot more annoying to be trapped in here if it weren't for this spacious interior and these very comfortable bucket seats. I can relax. I can lean my back to almost laying down.
And with this dual zone climate control, while I'm sweating, worrying about us being trapped in this car, you can relax. Okay, well, and then the last couple stories are cyber spying and anti-piracy tech. And the anti-piracy tech one, you won't believe the third thing in the anti-piracy. No. Sorry, I forgot we don't have ads, and our listeners support us directly. No, on the cyber espionage, this one, there's a Russian cyber spy group. You know, you think that because you're running Linux, you're smug and think that, you know, there's nothing out there to really get you. There's a cyber espionage group of Russian origin known as PawnStorm is infecting Linux systems with a simple but effective Trojan program that does not require highly privileged access. Normally, part of the thing with Linux is that, you know, I mean, it is a Unix system, and it has, you know, the permissions to do stuff can be as tightly controlled as you want to take the time to do. PawnStorm, also known as APT-28, SOFACY, or SEDNIT, is a group of attackers that has been active since at least 2007. Over the years, the group has targeted government, security, and military organizations from NATO member countries, as well as defense contractors and media organizations. They've also gone after Ukrainian political activists and critics of the Kremlin. So I'm sure they have nothing to do with Russia, right? The group is known but for using zero-day exploits, exploits for previously unknown vulnerabilities, as well as other infection techniques like spear phishing emails with malicious attachments. Its primary tool is a Windows backdoor program called SedNit, but the group also uses malware programs for Mac OS X, Linux, and even mobile OSs. Its preferred malware tool for Linux, though, is a Trojan program called, I don't know how you pronounce this, FISBIS, F-Y-S-B-I-S. According to researchers from security firm Palo Alto Networks, it has a modular architecture allowing attackers to expand its functionality as needed through plugins that get pushed down to individual victims. Palo Alto researchers said Friday in a blog post, quote, FISBIS can install itself to a victim system with or without root privileges. This increases the options available to an adversary when it comes to selecting accounts for installation. You know, the main thing is their FISBIS is designed for data theft. As such, even if it doesn't get control over the whole system, it can still achieve its primary goal of stealing sensitive documents that the user has access to or spying on the user's web browsing and other activities. It sounds like this is aimed at desktops, you know, desktop type users. FISBIS shows that advanced persistent threat actors, APT, don't often require advanced methods to reach their objectives. Quote, despite the lingering belief and false sense of security that Linux inherently yields higher degrees of protection from malicious actors, Linux malware and vulnerabilities do exist and are in use by advanced adversaries. It might explain why many attack groups have added Linux Trojans to their respective arsenals in recent years, regardless of whether their motivation was espionage or traditional cybercrime.
All right. Well, that noise, I mean sound, or whatever, is indication that we're going to kind of take a little bit of a break here. We're having a great episode of Technology Bites. It's much more casual and relaxed without those annoying other hosts here. this is like double barrel payback for the times that I'm gone, because instead of just being able to kind of poke at one person for not being here, I got half the crew is gone. Take that, Barrett Lee and Groove House. Thanks for that, guys. All right, so yeah, it's time for us to take a short break, which we're gonna do.
You're gonna ask me to step out of the room for a minute while you blast me as well.
I get you out of the way. I've got a picture of you where you're not covering your face. All right, well, you're listening to Technology Bites. I'm Jay Lee.
I'm Peter Hughes.
I'm Flicted.
And we'll be back after these messages.
Early voting for the March primaries has begun. From now through February 26th, any voter registered in Harris County who lives within the city of Houston or HISD can vote early. For early voting, any voter registered in Harris County can choose a location regardless of where in Harris County you are registered. You can visit harrisvotes.com for a complete list of polling places and voting hours. You are encouraged to exercise your right to vote. This is 90.1 KPFT Houston, kpft.org worldwide. Find us on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, and YouTube at KPFT Houston.
It's blowing in the wind. The answer is blowing in the wind.
Thousands of you have heeded the call, but there's always room for more. You can find KPFT on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and YouTube. From our latest updates to funny videos, contests, news, and more, you can find us anytime, day or night. We're at KPFT Houston on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and YouTube. We'd love to give you the latest. Plus, you're already on Facebook. Why not get behind the scenes of Houston's leader for independent music, arts, ideas, and culture right now? Again, find us at KPFT Houston on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and YouTube. See you there.
We now return to the abbreviated version of Technology Bites.
Keep using that word. I do not mean think it means what you think it means.
That's inconceivable.
Welcome back to Technology Bites. We're so glad you're here. I don't know if any of the other hosts are listening. It'd be funny if Grewhouse or Barrett or Lee were tuned in, but maybe Lee's still tweeting, so apparently he's not feeling that bad.
Well, I think it was his voice was messed
up,
right?
Yeah, he said he had no voice. Maybe that was it. But according to his wife, Laura, he was... when he did finally decide to go to the doctor this weekend, he was delirious on whatever medication they gave him and was asking if we had made our goal the previous week. Oh, that wacky guy. All right, so...
I guess there's no Barrett time.
There is. Just kidding.
Strangely enough, Gil Barrett.
No, as it turns out, we made the info shot last for an hour. Now, we may have a whole new format coming up. Imagine how long it would have taken to get through those news stories with everyone here.
Well, I think, you know, obviously the deal would be to tailor it based on how many people are around and how long we talk between stories. But, yeah, the last one was kind of interesting, the last story for the news. You know, piracy of like PC games and that of, you know, computer games is just rampant. And apparently somebody has come up with an anti-piracy approach that has been somewhat successful. Apparently more than 2 months after release, it's still not possible to pirate Just Cause 3 or Rise of the Tomb Raider, which were both released for PC in late January. Cracking computer games used to be measured in hours or days, but now it's turning into weeks and months, and it's affecting the nature of piracy. The surest sign was a rare note of surrender from China-based 3DM, one of the world's most popular cracking groups. They've made waves recently for suggesting that, quote, there will be no free games to play, unquote, in 2 years. They reportedly backed away from cracking single-player games, too, but there's some dispute over those reports. 3DM and every other group in the cracking scene has been frustrated, banging their head against the piracy roadblock that is a relatively new anti-tamper tech from the Austrian company Denuvo. It's the tech that Square Enix used to protect Just Cause 3, the tech they also used for Tomb Raider, and the tech that Ubisoft is using for next week's Far Cry Primal. Anti-tamper, according to Denuvo. Oh, they spelled it differently in different places. Denuvo, I think, is their real name of the company.
I like
is
Denuvo. Different... Are we not bad?
We are Denuvo. anti-tamper is different from digital rights management, DRM, which has had a historically poor reputation with players. Anti-tamper prevents the debugging, reverse engineering, and changing of executable files, a company spokesperson told. I found this at Kotaku.com. There's a confusing non-explanation about how Denuvo works, but since they have pirates on their heels, they're not exactly going to tell everything about their how it works. At the heart of it, finally, later in the article, they tell how they do it. And what it is they, since to, when you get your computer game through Steam, they generate a key that's tied to that particular machine that downloaded the software, which is kind of, you know, it's one of those where you kind of wonder why they didn't do it sooner on the download stuff. I mean, it's one thing on a DVD or a CD where you're installing the software. Obviously, you can't make a dynamic key to stop you from, say, installing that same software on 20 different computers. But when it's coming through online, of course you could, you know, you should be able to put a custom key. And so what they do, apparently, the rough thought of what they do without, obviously they didn't give a lot of details, is that they generate this unique key for that copy of the game and then have triggers that need that key correctly. So that if you don't have the right key, so when they think they've cracked it in one spot, essentially you hit different points in the game and it can make the game unplayable because each time, because they have to basically jump the hurdle of generating the correct key and providing it every time you hit that spot. The other thing that was interesting in the article is that the goal isn't to make it impossible to pirate games, but what they're trying to do is raise the friction to keep piracy, delay the piracy for as long as possible during that initial time when people are buying the game. Because a lot of times it sounds like it comes down to if people can get a free cracked version, they'll just take that and not buy. But if they can't get a pirated version, that they'll actually pony up and buy the thing. So DeNuvo's anti-tamper's goal is to keep game piracy free for the initial sales release window when most of the sales are made. Just Cause 3. I don't know if you've seen Just Cause 3. It's pretty funny. You basically play this guy who, I guess, is returned to his homeland and it's been captured by some foreign army. And he basically runs around and blows stuff up. And he has a thing where he, like, hooks cords up to people and cars and stuff. And if he hooks a couple of them up to them, it will launch them into the air like a rubber band. It's one that's worth if you're not interested in doing it, it's a fun one to watch somebody else play. If you go see the different YouTubers that are doing it, there's a guy named Jacksepticeye, and if you watch him play it, he really has fun. But so Just Cause 3 is a just fun run around and blow stuff up kind of game so far. But it's 78 days that it's been not pirated. Rise of the Tomb Raider is 20 days. The longest record for DeNuvo is for Lords of the Fallen, which is a Dark Souls-style game from late 2014, and that went 272 days without being cracked. On the other hand, they broke Metal Gear Solid 5, The Phantom Pain. 3DM did that early on, but have not been able to maintain that success, so... the thing, this Chinese group, they're like public, they have a public face. They have like employees, quote, employees who have public profiles on the Chinese equivalent of Twitter. And they have a blog that discusses their activities. There's a woman whose nickname that she goes by is Bird Sister, who regularly updates a blog discussing their, discussing what they're doing. So the battle keeps going on. It sounds like with this signature thing, though, that they actually have gotten to something where it's hard to pirate a game. And if it does work, then clearly the battle is on now, and so it'll be interesting to see how that goes. Because I know the DRM thing, the different approaches they had was like the hateful, you know, where you had to have the disc to play the game. That was nobody, even people who weren't pirates would get the don't need a disc hack or patch for their games because it was such a pain in the butt to have to put the disc in to play the game. But
virtual CD-ROM.
There you go.
Before that, when you had to have a physical dongle to put in a computer for a piece of software to work.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, well, and there were some, you know, obviously when a lot of the software used to be a lot more expensive. Quark used to like pull the local network and it would broadcast and check for serial numbers across the LAN to make sure there weren't two copies of it running at the same time with the same serial number. Obviously, it's kept them successful since everybody still uses Quark to do their... Oh, wait, nobody... Actually, I guess a lot of newspapers still do, but it's very... It's gotten very limited. So, and that's the news.
All right. An hour and 9 minutes into the show.
And it still hasn't been cracked.
I will say that tonight's show had one of the most flawless intros we've ever had. Another reason why I think I'm going to wake up. And that and this rainbow tail.
Maybe we need to have a rotating cast where there's always somebody missing. Because then there's, first off, you can make fun of them. And second, then there's fewer.
I do my part to get out of here a few times a year.
Going and seeing interesting places. What's your next interesting place to go? Has that been decided yet, or is it
has
still...
not been decided. We are contemplating the highest in contention right now is Nova Scotia. That was a great time cough. It's cheap to fly there. It's only about $500 round trip to Halifax, and it looks like it's got some pretty majestic scenery there. But if it's not there, it's going to be North Scotland or Norway.
Ah, cool.
Nobody seems to get excited about Nova.
So you're looking for places that start with the letter N.
Yeah,
is there some
baby going back
or
to New
actually N O maybe?
Or going back to New Zealand or Niceland.
Well, if you're going to go to Nova Scotia,
Nicaragua,
no,
Nigeria,
no.
Well, they did
never,
get an
never,
invitation
never.
To a prince.
What's that?
For a prince, there was a Nigerian prince who offered them a special Airbnb rate to get $1 million out of the country.
Well, there's an island near Nova Scotia, or off Nova Scotia, where Canada is saying that if Trump wins the presidency, that Americans that want to flee the country can live there.
It's like a fishing village on an island, a remote island there. Well, if you're going to Nova Scotia, you probably need to watch the movie Goon, which I think is on Netflix, which frankly, if you like hockey movies that are kind of funny, if you liked Slapshot way back when, you would like Goon. But also you should probably watch Trailer Park Boys, because that's over in that part of Canada. And there's only like 9 or 10 seasons of it to watch.
Wow.
It's fairly funny. It's an odd show, but clearly it's lasted. So
just make sure
like
if you do that, just make sure and take a old fashioned glass with you and always have it in your hand the entire time everywhere you go.
Well, we'll see. It's still up in the air. Although it's amazing that it's already almost the end of February in 2016. This year is gotten off to a great start. But the 80-degree day we had the other day or yesterday here in Houston, Texas, in the middle of winter. Criminy.
Yeah, it's so strange because over the weekend there was that big like winter storm that hit New England and that. And, you know, we're looking, you know, they're reporting on that while you're wearing shorts and driving to, you know, with the windows down to go to the store. And some of them have embraced it. I noticed Costco has like all their like summer stuff is just out now. It's all the lawn furniture and barbecues and pool equipment and all this other stuff is all through there. So I guess they're kind of, at least for Texas, they're embracing the whole global warming thing and seeing what they can sell us.
All right. So we got some segments we can do here in the next 45 minutes. So cue up the music.
Here we go.
Crunch.
So the not surprising thing, you know, I'll put it out there. Yes, it's a rumor, but it's not one that's going to shock you. The there's a target that Apple's apparently hit, and it's thought that the 4-inch iPhone, also known as the iPhone 5SE, and a new iPad Air could surface at an event Tuesday, March 15th. The thing that will be different, though, is the products would be up for sale online and in stores on that Friday, March the 18th. And so Apple wouldn't have pre-orders on the devices, according to sources who stated that the plans could still change. So that would be a change. Usually Apple has their event. They announce like within a week that pre-orders start, and then within a couple weeks or 2 weeks or 3 weeks later, then they have the normal sales. And this one, it sounds like they have ramped up the production and are going to be ready to sell the devices within a few days after the event. The iPad Air 3 is rumored to include a smart connector that can support accessories like the smart keyboard and the Apple Pencil. Those were things that were aimed for the iPad Pro, and so they're apparently moving down in the line. The device is also expected to include a variant of the A9 processor, an upgraded camera, and potentially a new a rear flash for brighter photos. At the March 15th event, Apple's also planning to unveil, according to the rumors, a series of new Apple Watch Sport Band colors, a space black Milanese loop, and NATO-style nylon bands. So, ooh, watch bands. I don't know. That's hard to get all that excited that there's – ooh, they're going to have a whole new watch. I guess they're trying to, like, capture that Swatch mania.
I was
going to
say
it's like the mid-'80s. Next, they'll be coming out with those jelly shoes like the girls all
wear. Rubby wearing raw cotton vests with padded shoulders, wicker boat shoes without socks.
Well, maybe the tube top will make its return. That's one that came around and. Doesn't seem to be making its way back into regular use. Here's an interesting one. An Apple bug, the 1970 date bug, affects 64-bit iPhones, iPads, and iPod Touch devices.
Wait a minute. 64-bit? Are there 32-bit iPhones?
I don't know. I guess there's the older ones. Were some of the earlier ones 32-bit? Because didn't iOS go...
I have never heard of an Apple device referred to in like, you know, as a 32-bit or a 64-bit, not like a PC. Like if you have it used to be you could get a 32 or 64-bit, and now you can run 32 or 64-bit operating system software on a Windows computer, but I've never heard that in reference to a Mac.
Really. I think, I don't remember what version of OS X. There was a specific version of OS X where they like talked about the fact that they had completely gone all 64-bit. So I think there was a period where even the Intel based was 32-bit, or some of it was 32-bit.
Huh. Yeah. I think part of why it's not been as big a deal is because once they decided to change, everything went to the new, went to that, to the 64-bit, and it's done, as opposed to like Windows where they still have, there's the 32-bit version of the system software, and that kind of stuff is kind of stuck around on a lot of stuff. But so here, if you want to screw up your life, manually changing the date to May 1970 or earlier can prevent your iOS device from turning on after a restart. An upcoming software update will prevent this issue from affecting iOS devices. And if you have this issue, you're supposed to contact Apple support. I'm betting the first question Apple support asks you is, why in the world would you need to change your device to 1970 for the dates? I mean, what, you're planning to travel back in time to...
Now, there are people like that in the world that they find something that never occurs in the real world that's wrong with your software or your technology, and then they push you for, like, you've got to fix this. Like, I had a user today who was incensed because something had caused his computer to not be able to download email unless he was connected to the VPN. And it was just, you know, it works normally. I don't know what was going on at this time, but it's like, how is this a problem? Connect to the VPN. Get your email.
I can only get my email if I do this. It's like, well, then do that.
Right, exactly. But no, it's like I found a flaw with your technology. It's not working. And the way that the ticket was worded, the way that it came across in the
complete mail outage.
No, it was more like prior to 11:30 a.m. I was able to connect to the email without launching the VPN, and now I must launch the VPN to get my email. Please fix. Which didn't really give any indication whether I should, like, call him to fix it, or was he expecting me to go flip the VPN needed, not needed switch from on and off? I don't know. But, yeah, so the 1970 bug, back to that.
Well, the theory is that basically Unix time starts at 00:00:00 UTC on January 1, 1970. And so you can't manually set your iOS device to a date prior to then. Apparently, when you get it closer to May 1970 or earlier, for some reason, it ends up with they think that it gets a negative integer, and that that's a date prior to January 1, 1970, and that it screws up the booting sequence for some reason. But there's a patch coming, so if you're an idiot who bricks your own phone by changing it to the early 1970, you know, it's one thing if you're contacting Apple support from your time travel adventure in 1970, so you did the Western Union thing where you put the note in and have it delivered now.
He really is from the future. His phone is broken.
Actually, what somebody needs to do is
my phone doesn't work in 1970.
Have some other device. No, you have some just like block of metal or something, and you walk around now. And it's the iPhone 20, and you're a time traveler. But apparently, since in 2016, if you set your date back to 2016, it bricks your phone. See, I really am a Tumbra. So anyway, so there's a patch coming if you've been foolish enough to try that.
I'm trying to think, like, either somebody typoed it to find this, or they were trying to do some joke where they wanted the phone to look like it was from the 60s or earlier, and then the phone wouldn't boot anymore after they tried to make the joke.
Well, it seemed like it's not really a secret with sort of the Unix orientation of Apple stuff at the, you know, kind of lowest levels, that then, you know, 0 day being 1970 would not be a big surprise that you can't put it back before then. You know, I guess you just wonder. I mean, you'd think after Y2K, maybe they would have figured out that they need to make it so that it'll work at any time. It does seem, in some ways, it seems sort of counterintuitive, but that's because humans, you know, we just, you know, the calendar just cycles through, where on the computer, each date and time, each moment is unique. And so that's why they start at a zero and it just goes up from there. It's the number of seconds since January 1, 1970 is the time on your computer. And so that's why it doesn't work right. Oh, and now here's the side effect. I think somebody posted on Facebook where they felt really good because today they plugged in a USB device on the first try. Well, so then there's, you know, the USB-C cables that could go either direction. Yeah, well, there's always, you always pay for it somehow. Apple has announced that it will offer free replacements for certain charging cables that use the USB Type-C specification because some of them have not been working correctly. Isn't that nice? People who entered their mailing addresses upon setting up their 2015 USB-C equipped MacBook notebooks can expect to receive the new cable by the end of the month, provided they're eligible for the replacement. So if you got a MacBook, you may want to check on that and make sure that you're not affected by it. But, you know, apparently the reason for the single direction USB thing was that it's a lot more complicated to make one that works in either in both directions, and so now they've had to have a recall. So isn't that a treat?
Great.
So that's all the Apple-y stuff. So hey, we got through that one a lot quicker.
But going back to the Apple stuff just for a minute. So the Apple's got an announcement coming in March, right? Is that what we hear?
Yeah.
And do and the iPad hasn't been refreshed in a while.
Right. So they think it's the iPad 3, a mini iPhone, the 5SE or ES, and then some watch related, not a new watch, not a next generation watch, but like some enhancements to the existing one. I wonder if around that same time, if there won't be some hardware refreshes on like the MacBook Pro and some of those where they'll put the better processors in, but it's not worthy of a, you know, full on media event to, you know, announce that, oh, hey, look, this MacBook Pro with Retina display that looks exactly the same now is marginally faster because we put a different, you know, put a different processor in it. That doesn't have a lot of drama. And so that'll just probably, you know, so they may just, you know, when the Apple Store goes down for that, for the new iPads and that stuff, they'll just, you know, boost the specs on the on some of the laptops and stuff and call it a day.
So on this iPhone date thing, does it only happen if you actually set the time to that, or if you actually scroll back when you're setting the time? Because I went into it and I turned off set time automatically, and I've scrolled back and it stopped it around 2002, but if I kept pulling down, it started going back about 7 years at a time. So now I'm to January 23rd, 1975. But if I pull down again, it's probably going to take me before 1970.
That may be part of the problem then, is that the interface is jumping you to a negative date.
So I don't really, I don't want to.
If it remembers your...
I'm not selecting it. I'm just scrolling. But I really don't want to. Uh oh. Too late.
No, this sounds like one of those things. Oh.
It took me back to December 31st, 1969.
What's it like?
I don't know. I'm hoping that
clothes different.
I'm hoping I can get back to something more recent. Ooh, yeah. I was able to scroll back up to 1971.
Oh wow!
I didn't select it. I just scrolled like to pick the date.
Yeah, that seems more like the kind of thing like, hey man, let me borrow your phone for a second.
Yeah,
to try then, as opposed to.
Yeah, Jay, do you have your phone unlocked? Could I see it for a second? Oh,
no.
You.
All right, next segment. Turntape over.
In the geek world, we hear about new gadgets and gizmos every day. But can they stand a dip in the snart tank? So have you wondered, you know, the Tesla, now the Model X, the electric SUV is coming out. And have you wondered what would happen if you had a drag race between a Model S and a Model X? You know, yeah, maybe I hadn't either. But apparently this one couple, they already had a Tesla Model S and they ordered the Model X. And so the husband and wife went to a drag race, you know, to a track, and actually put the vehicles side by side and drag raced them. Just in case you didn't know, the Tesla Model X SUV is the fastest SUV ever. Not just an American SUV, not just electric. It is the Model X P90D's combined horsepower of over 530 from its front and rear motors take it from 0 to 60 in 3.2 seconds. So even the like Lamborghini, they had like some kind of SUV, can't keep up. the result, the interesting thing with the electric cars is the Model S was slightly faster. The Model X weighs 600 pounds more than the Model S, and yet the Model S was only 0.37 seconds and 2.5 miles per hour faster than the SUV. So, you know, so now you know that if you get the Model X, that you're not going to be compromising on very much on your drag racing ability, and so you'll be able to take the kids to soccer practice. Well, it'll be that, you know, 0.37 seconds slower than if you did it in the Model S with ludicrous mode. But I figured that was one. This one, they can try it, so you don't have to. So you know that's what happens with the with the Teslas. I think that it's sort of fascinating because it has shut up the crowd that says that electric cars that are just totally impractical and nobody's going to want one. Because I must say that that really more than any other vehicle, a Tesla Model S would be on the top of my, like, if I won the lottery list to get one or suddenly had, you know, some kind of big funding thing. Here's one, a interesting one. Researchers at Southampton University in the UK have found a way to use laser light to store 360 terabytes of information on nanostructured quartz. Now, but it's only temporary. When you do the laser light to store the data, it will only last for up to 14 billion years. It uses femtosecond laser pulses to write data in the 3D structure of quartz.
It'll last longer than there'll be things that can read the data.
Well, then there'll be,
outdated. It'll be zip drives of the future, you know. So you'll have this, it's permanently stored there, but they no longer make the device that reads it.
So basically it creates three layers of nanostructured dots, each just 5 microns above the other. The changes in the structure can be read by interrogating the sample with another pulse of light and recording its polarization, the orientation of the waves, after it's passed through. So it's these little, like, small glass discs that are about the size of a quarter. And they've written a series of major works to these glass discs, including the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, Newton's Optics, the Magna Carta, and the King James Bible. The density of data aboard these discs suggests they could squeeze a total of 360 terabytes onto a single piece of quartz. The idea of archiving data this way has been around for a while, but until now the density of data storage has been too modest. Back in 2012, a similar technique was used to store 40 megabytes per square inch, approximately the same density of data as a music CD. But this new one makes archiving vast quantities of information permanently possible. That's one that you just wonder. 360 terabytes, that's so something the size of a stack of quarters could hold, like, every piece of data on the internet. Of course, I wonder how long it would take to write that. But you could, you know, essentially 360 terabytes is a library's worth of books, or many libraries' worth of books on one piece of quartz. You wonder how hard it would be to manufacture a bunch of those. But that's one I would like to try.
Yeah, I would like. It looked like the picture I saw of it looks like it could put it onto something the size of a contact lens.
There you go. That'd work. Or if they just put sections of the screen of your smartphone, have the data already in it, could be kind of cool.
Yeah.
But, well, so I'd certainly like to try it once they, some of it, the question, the things, you know, they these huge capacity and long life, then usually the thing that's missing is how long does it take to write this stuff? And how long does it take to read it? Is it very quick? Would be the question. You know, how useful is it to get the data back out and use it without just, like, getting all the data out so you could search it or stuff like that? I mean, you get into some real interesting, how do you organize this where you can find stuff if it's 360 terabytes?
Yeah.
So that is a heck of a lot of data.
Index it?
I guess it'd have to be part of the whole thing where there'd be an index that tells where stuff is on it, maybe. But so that one will clearly that this could be very useful for storing documents and stuff. So finally, we could be getting closer to the paperless office. But now you'll just have a stack of little glass discs or quartz discs, and so you'll drop one and break it, and you'll have just lost 360 terabytes of your important data.
That's okay. I've got a drawer full of backups over here.
I'm wearing one of my backups as a monocle.
Yeah, it's appearing through your data.
And so have any of you heard of this one's just sort of hit my consciousness because I guess they've been showing trailers occasionally on things. 10 Cloverfield Lane.
I saw the preview for that. The first preview I saw of it, though I really liked the preview because it wasn't obvious till the very end of the preview of what the scenario or what the storyline was going to be. And I knew from the title that it was a sequel to Cloverfield, but...
Oh, no, then I don't know.
It's apparently a blood relative of Cloverfield. J.J. Abrams is indirectly involved. For those of you who haven't heard anything about it, it's called 10 Cloverfield Lane. They had a trailer, I think, with the Super Bowl, and then also they had a trailer this weekend before Deadpool. And it's three people in a bunker. This girl is in a car accident, and she wakes up, and she's in this bunker. And John Goodman, who's always an interesting actor, is the guy. It's his bunker, and he says that he's got her in there because that's going to keep her alive because everyone outside of the bunker is dead. And since it's supposedly bloodline tied to Cloverfield, then you wonder, does that mean there's monsters outside or what? The cast, it's like I said, it's John Goodman and Mary Elizabeth Winstead.
Well, the first preview I saw, the first trailer I saw for it, the preview makes you think that it's some kind of psychopath who's holding a prisoner in an underground bunker. And there's something like the fact that it was called Cloverfield made me think, okay, this has got to be related to the original Cloverfield movie, but this doesn't look like anything having to do with Cloverfield. And then towards the end of the trailer, they reveal that, yeah, it's just something different.
So at the end of the most recent trailer, she goes out, there's a scene that's from outside of the bunker behind with a house with like light and the sound of a monster like roar kind of thing, but you don't see anything. So I don't know. Cloverfield was kind of, it was interesting to me as a movie itself, and this doesn't have, in case you saw Cloverfield and the shaky cam stuff drove you nuts, it doesn't look like this is not a found footage kind of movie, so that you don't have to worry about the shaky cam if you're intrigued by it. I guess I'm waiting. I want to see some reviews, and then I could be tempted to see it based on the cast and some of that, but I think I want to see some reviews before I would try it. But it does well, and there's the other thing that's creepy. If you go to geekradio.com and follow the link on it, it shows the most recent trailer, and it's like the word help is like scratched on the outside glass of the bunker on the window. So pretty creepy stuff. But I guess sort of finally on Try Buy or Fry, how many of you missed like BattleBots or the various robot fighting TV shows that used to be on, and wish you could do that at home.
Oh, okay. There was a new BattleBots, some kind of show on prime time on broadcast television that was actually pretty good here last season.
Now, if you want to do that at home, yeah, I guess last summer BattleBots returned. So the response from fans was so overwhelming that not only did ABC renew the series for a second season, which I guess is coming up, but Hexbug, I don't know if you've been at the if you've been in the right aisle at the toy store,
you've seen
the Hexbugs, or yeah, I guess some of the Geek Gatherings had Hexbugs. They have turned the league's most popular robots into tiny remote control toys you can battle at home. They have an arena, which is about $70. It's a 20-by-20-inch playset with four clear plastic topped walls, two corners with manually operated hammers, graphics that recreate the appearance of the real life arena, and two miniature remote control battle bots with wireless controllers. I'm thinking we maybe need, this might be something we need to figure out how to have on hand for the next Geek Gathering so we can have robot fighting in the parking lot at Coates. To further up the competition, Witch Doctor with its vertically mounted spinning flywheel can also be added to the arena playset for $30. You can get the robots. Some of them come with this kit and you can buy some separately. But it's actually the miniatures of the bot, of some of the battle bots from the show, because it has the names on them, like Tombstone and Bronco and Witch Doctor.
That was like wrestling when I watched the show last season and on DVR because I want to fast forward through all the talk because they have announcers and it's like wrestling, but instead of wrestlers, it's robots.
Apparently, with the battery-operated ones, they won't start smoking or catch fire after brutal smackdowns like the ones on TV. But they do feature panels and accessories that come flying off in the heat of battle. But after a fight, they're a lot easier to reassemble and repair than the real thing, and you don't have to wear safety glasses. There's a good, think this way you can take kids away from their violent video games and let them do violent games that you can do right there in person. That's got to be a good idea somehow. Until the kid figures out how to hack your Tesla and start using it like a battle bot. And there was one other, I don't know, this one's limited. Right now it's just a limited trial. And I guess I wonder what people think. Google Express, the search engine's home delivery service, is beginning to ship fresh grocery items to consumers, according to the Wall Street Journal. Right now, it's only select areas of San Francisco and L.A. They say that it's got a four-hour delivery window, and the minimum charge is $35 plus a $3 surcharge. But I don't know. It seems like there's times where food delivery, like having your groceries for $3 per order, that's not bad. You wonder if the order's big, do they charge you a lot more or what? But it would be kind of nice sometimes to just call and have somebody deliver your there's like fresh stuff, like fresh fruit and vegetables, where before you couldn't. Rather than the way Google's doing it is it's a middleman between retailers and consumers. So rather than setting up like a logistics center itself, like its own warehouse, which I think is Amazon's approach, they're simply going to drive a van to a partner supermarket, pick up your stuff, and drop it off at your place. So they are working with like Costco and some other stores, like Trader Joe's, Costco, and Whole Foods. So that model could end up working in other places like Houston. I think the toughest part is getting people to try it for the first time, because it's kind of like you have to think of it and need it at the right time, and somebody does have to be home to get the stuff. You don't want to get home and it turns out they got there early and left your milk out on the front porch sitting there spoiling in the Houston sun.
Yum.
So there's that. I also wonder, there's the other thing that can be a problem. LA is pretty sprawling. San Francisco, not so much, but neither of them have anything to compare with Houston on the like sheer size and sprawl approach. So you just wonder if it would only be if it would be only downtown, you know, an inside the loop kind of Houston thing, or you know, if there'd just be pockets where they would try to do some kind of delivery like that.
So who were the places they said they were doing this for?
Well, they just mentioned that some of among the ones they're working with were Costco and Whole Foods as options. I don't know if the deal is that they, you know, if you give them a very specific list and it's tied to a particular store, or because obviously like Costco, you know, you'd have to tell them you wanted, you know, a metric ton of paper towels to be delivered to your home. you know, because like, if you just need one, they're not going to go to Costco. They can't go to Costco for that unless they're just going to like break a package and share it amongst peoples. So, and I guess we're coming. We've only got 15 minutes left, but we're down to the last segment.
My calculations are correct. When this baby hits 88 miles per hour, you're going to see some serious
science.
So going past, you know, you can have your zombie apocalypses and all that kind of stuff. Discover Magazine's blog has an article that says what it would be like, what to expect if the Earth ever falls into a black hole. There's one. So if you've been worrying about stuff, they ask the questions about black holes, and the main interesting question they come up with in the article is the effect they think might happen of spaghettification.
I was gonna say everybody would get much taller.
Well, yeah, the thing that's interesting is when you're talking about the kind of extreme gravitational stuff, the gradient of a black hole, the gravitational pull closer to the black hole is dramatically stronger than farther away, you know, even just a few inches kind of thing. And so you'll get like all stretched out and distorted. It says, let's see, since your feet are physically closer to the black hole, they will feel a stronger gravitational pull toward it than your head will. Worse than that, your arms, by virtue of the fact they're not at the center of your body, will be attracted in a slightly different vector direction than your head is. This will cause parts of the body towards the edges to be brought inward. The net result is not only an elongation of the body overall, but also a thinning out or compression in the middle. Hence, your body or any other object, such as the entire planet Earth, will start to resemble spaghetti long before it hits the center of the black hole. I'm kind of comforted because I was worried it was going to be more like the end of that Disney movie from the 80s. The black hole where they went through and it was like some kind of hellscape on the other side. So, you know, one of these subheadings in this article is bad news for Earth. You kind of, you know, it's like, you know, I thought that was sort of in the premise of the whole article. But one thing they do say is we may not notice if a truly supermassive black hole swallowed us below its event horizon, as everything would appear as it once was, at least for a small period of time. So basically it would just be, you know, I guess, you know, would it be sort of like time stops and you're just crushed? We all get crunched together into spaghetti at the same time. So so there's that one. So now you know what'll happen. You'll turn into spaghetti. And so if you want to have something to worry about, you know, if in case you weren't worried enough with the zombie thing or Zika virus or inflation or else compression, you know, the Big Bang or the big whatever the opposite one was called that I forget now. Now you could worry about the sudden appearance of a mega black hole near the Earth. And then here's one. Somebody 110,000 years was getting busy. They found human DNA in the toe bone of a Neanderthal woman. Early ancestors of humans in Africa interbred with the Neanderthals about 110,000 years ago. An international group of researchers reports online February 17th in Nature. The genetic mixing left its mark on the DNA of a Siberian Neanderthal, the researchers have discovered. While many humans today carry bits of Neanderthal DNA, this is the first time human DNA has been found embedded in the Neanderthal's genes. If it's correct, it indicates the relationship between humans and Neanderthals goes further back and is more complicated than scientists supposed.
It's complicated.
Says Sarah Tishkoff. Yeah. Humans never call. Evidence of Stone Age interbreeding was uncovered when researchers found traces of Neanderthal DNA slipped into the human genetic instruction book. Today, about 1.5% to 4% of the genomes of non-Africans is made up of Neanderthal DNA. Some of that DNA actually may increase the risk of certain diseases. So isn't that nice? So now you can thank your non-human ancestors for that.
Like knuckle dragging.
So about 1% to 7.1% of a 50,000-year-old Siberian Neanderthal woman's DNA contains traces of human DNA, according to Adam Siepel, a computational biologist at Cold Spring Harbor Lab in New York. The woman's toe bone, found in the same cave in the Altai Mountains as the only known fossils of extinct human cousins called Denisovans, yielded some of the most well-preserved Neanderthal DNA ever analyzed. So it's just interesting. I'm trying to figure out how this one fits into the whole creation story. Maybe the Neanderthal was named Steve, and so it was Adam and Steve. Mm. And anyway. Mm. Yeah, if you listen to this long through the show, you're not offended. Well, you're going to turn it off now. And then the last one, the big science news this week that, again, kind of got past it overcame the gravitational pull of the geekosphere and got out into the rest of the world. Einstein's, one of the last things on Einstein's theories was about gravitational waves, which he came up with this 100 years ago. But it took this long for them to find a test where they could confirm the prediction. Essentially, in another galaxy a billion or so light years away, two black holes collided, shaking the fabric of space-time. And so here on Earth, two giant detectors on opposite sides of the United States quivered ever so slightly as gravitational waves washed over them. So they actually directly detected the waves with the recently upgraded laser interferometer gravitational wave observatory, now known as Advanced LIGO. It appears to have succeeded, ushering in a new era of astronomy. So essentially it's ripples in the fabric of space-time that radiate from those kinds of catastrophes, two big black holes crashing into each other. And the ripples are very subtle. By the time they reach Earth, some of them compress space-time by as little as 1/10,000th the width of a proton. To spot the signal, so how did they make this work? To spot a signal, LIGO uses a special mirror to split a beam of laser light and sends the beams down two 4-kilometer-long arms at a 90-degree angle to each other. After ricocheting back and forth 400 times, turning each beam's journey into a 1,600-kilometer round trip, the light recombines near its source. The experiment's designed so that in normal conditions, the light waves cancel one another out when they recombine, so no light goes to a nearby detector. But a gravitational wave stretches one tube while squeezing the other, which changes the distance the beams travel relative to each other. Because of the difference in distance, the recombining waves are no longer perfectly aligned, and therefore they don't cancel out, and the detector picks up a faint glow, which signals a passing gravitation wave. That's pretty darn subtle. That's pretty amazing that somebody came up with how you could do that. Some other sources of gravitational waves, apparently, spinning neutron stars, The core left behind after a massive star explodes can whip up space-time at frequencies similar to those produced by colliding black holes. Supernovas, that one you would figure was doing, would have, you know, that kind of giant explosion would give you a gravitational wave. Supermassive black hole pairs of gargantuan black holes, more than a million times as massive as the sun and larger, a million times as massive as the sun and larger than the ones Advanced LIGO detected, radiate long undulating waves. Though Advanced LIGO can't detect waves at this frequency, scientists might spot them by looking for subtle variations in the steady beat of pulsars. And then the ultimate one, the gravitational waves left from the Big Bang. The Big Bang might have triggered universe-sized gravitational waves 13.8 billion years ago. So they may be able to be seen in the cosmic microwave background. So big news on that. You know, it's one of those where you kind of, you know, I wonder what they can do with it. I mean, obviously it confirms Einstein's theories, but and so it's really cool to know about, and that, you know, we're alive when they discovered it. But I wonder what else. I haven't seen anything else that they've said that it really could let us do that would be cool.
That guy was so pretty smart.
Einstein. Yeah, but analysts are saying that what has he come up with lately? He's not innovating fast enough now, and so his ideas are going to go stale on
He
us.
Just had that one weird trick.
You'll be shocked when you see the one weird trick. When you see what he could do with just one atom's worth of energy.
You'll be relatively amazed.
So it is amazing that, you know, the thing, I guess it's phenomenal when somebody can come up with this stuff with the mathematical equations. But then when somebody figures out how you test it, how you actually like test it in the real world, that certainly gets way beyond what I can certainly imagine. So that's all the content we have for tonight.
Right. Well, that pretty much
was. And we have to kill 30 seconds.
Oh, I can kill 30 seconds. Yes, give me a knife.
All right. Did anybody go and see Deadpool this weekend?
I nope. Took someone else's kids.
We can go see the Happy Pony, or, well, actually, did you see some of the viral marketing for Deadpool? They did actually market it as a like Valentine's rom-com.
Oh, I saw that. Yeah. All right. Well, that music tells us that we have come to the end of another episode of Technology Bites. So glad you could tune in, and thanks for sticking with us, even though we were at half strength. It felt like a double-powered show. So. Yay, hopefully we'll be back to full strength next week with stories.
Or
what?
Tune in next week and see who's missing or who's there. Who's been voted off the island.
Well, we'll see if we'll let them come back and with us. All right, well, you've been listening to Technology Bites. I'm Jay Lee.
I'm Peter Hughes.
And he's elected.
And no groove house for the Hawaiians.
Tune in Thursday at 4:30 for StuCon Radio by the Houston Independent School District Student Congress. The HIST Student Congress is an organization run by students for students. It's the Student Congress mission to be a bridge between students and administrators for the Houston Independent School District. Again, join KPFT on Thursday at 4:30 right before Democracy Now! Thanks for listening to KPFT Houston. Yeah!
great event will happen on March 9th. The Baker Institute Drug Policy Program will present a panel on law enforcement perspectives on drug prohibition. Panelists will include Harris County District Attorney Devon Anderson, Gary Hale, non-resident fellow in drug policy, former chief of intelligence at the Houston office of the DEA, Howard Wooldridge, drug policy specialist, Citizens Opposing Prohibition, founding member of Law Enforcement Against Prohibition, Texas State Representative Gene Wu. The moderator will be yours truly, Dean Becker, contributing expert at the Baker Institute, producer and host of the Drug Truth Network, and a LEAP speaker. This event is on March 9 at the James A. Baker Hall at Rice University from 6:30 to 8:30 p.m. To RSVP and to learn more, please visit BakerInstitute.org.